Guten Tag und willkommen zurück. This is episode number 18 and we are only two more episodes away from the end of season 2 and the summer break. And then we're going to start with a new season after the summer break, which will be only a couple weeks long, but I really need it. Having Professor Julia Simner on the podcast is such an honor. I reached out to her even before I started the podcast, and I'm so glad we got to sit down now and talk about what is synesthesia even. I think that's a very important reintroduction to the topic, because we really get into the nitty-gritty, and it's so important to hear these personal stories and more detailed things about synesthesia, but it's just as important to hear again what synesthesia even is. So it's a big, big honor to have Julia Simner for that kind of episode, and I'm so happy that she also confirmed to come back to talk about other topics such as aphantasia. And I have a couple other topics in mind, so it was a lovely, lovely conversation. I was starting to get sick when we were recording and didn't really know why my energy was low, but I really, really enjoyed it. She's so good at explaining. For those that don't know her, she's one of the very most important synesthesia researchers. She's in the field for more than 20 years and is one of the most influential researchers. So her knowledge about the topic is probably endless. Okay, then I have another two announcements to make. One is, if you follow me on Instagram and if you saw my stories about the Synesthesia Awareness Day, if you don't see my stories, you have to add me to close friends and then they will be shown to you. But if you didn't see that, we are hosting a virtual meetup on the very first Synesthesia Awareness Day, which is July 2nd. That's a Sunday. The event will be hosted at 2 p.m. British Standard Time, which after my little Google research seemed to be the best time to host an international event now that people from Alaska and New Zealand sign up. I don't know how we're going to make it work. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a 1 hour meetup, just random synesthetes and people who are interested in synesthesia. I wanted to still be a smaller group. If the group gets too big, I will split it into two halves, and that might also help me with the time zone problem. I'm gonna keep you posted on that. So it will be 1 hour of just a casual meetup. No presentation, no talks, nothing like that. And after that, whoever wants to join, we are hosting a virtual art party, which is so cool. So we're gonna meet for an hour right after the first meetup. And this is actually the idea and hosted by Ellie, one of my fellow synesthesia artists and friends I made over Instagram. We're gonna co-host the art party. So if you want to sign up for one of them, both of them, or you want to sign up but the time difference is so bad, please just send me a DM. And I'll try to figure it out. I'm getting really excited to see those faces behind the people that I text with on Instagram and people that comment and stuff. So, the other thing is, and I haven't mentioned it in the last couple episodes, but we're, of course, still looking for winners for Cine of the Month. We had a winner in May, and we're gonna have a new winner in June, obviously. So please submit your story. I'm gonna record the last episode for this month in 2 days. So submit your story, but also I just have a list of all the stories and I will go back to the stories in July and August and so on. Those were my three things that I wanted to mention. We're finishing up season 2 and there will be a summer break after. Second was the Synesthesia Awareness Day, how to sign up and what is planned. And the third one, if you want, submit your Cine of the Month story. Just a fun story, like a funny, weird situation due to your own synesthesia or someone else's. Just to have a laugh together can be short and simple. And now let's meet Professor Julia Simner. See you next week. And thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. And don't forget to review the podcast. I have another very special guest with me. I'm very, very excited for today's interview. With me is Professor Julia Simner from the University of Sussex in the south of England. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thanks so much. Please do call me Jules. Everybody does.
Cool. So you are a professor for neuropsychology and the director of the Multisense Lab, and you're also the author of multiple books, such as the Oxford Handbook of Synesthesia and the Very Short Introduction to Synesthesia, which is a series by the Oxford University Press.
That's correct. I'm actually the co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Synesthesia with Ed Hubbard. And when you co-edit one of these huge books, you actually have chapters written by all the colleagues in the field. So that was a really wonderful opportunity to draw together our collective knowledge as a discipline, really.
Absolutely. Cool. What we want to do today is have a kind of reintroduction of a basic, or not so basic, we'll see, conversation about what is synesthesia, what happens in the brain of a synesthete, how is it different to a non-synesthete, what do we know about genetics. Maybe you also want to give us some insight on how you got into synesthesia research, because from what I've read, you discovered synesthesia the year I was born. So yeah, if you are down, I would just give you the very first question of what is synesthesia?
Let's start with a big one. And actually, it seems like a simple question, what's synesthesia? And I can definitely give a simple answer. So synesthesia has been described as a sensory trait, a trait that some people have and other people don't. And it gives rise to a kind of merging of the senses. So for example, if you have synesthesia, then when you're listening to music, you might see coloured shapes in the visual field. You might see flashing coloured light in the visual field triggered by the music. Now, the problem with any simple definition is it's really, really never that simple. So there are lots of problems with that definition. And I've actually written a whole article called Defining Synesthesia, which talks about how hard it is to define. So one problem is that when we describe it as a merging of senses, we're really overlooking the fact that many types of synesthesia are not at all triggered by sensory information at all. So what are the senses? Well, if we think about the five senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. So if you think about one of the most common, most well-known forms of synesthesia, that's grapheme colour synesthesia, synesthesia triggered by letters and numbers. But the thing is, it's not triggered by seeing those letters and numbers or hearing those letters and numbers. It's triggered by something we'd refer to as cognition. It's triggered by thinking about those numbers. It's on letters. It's triggered by their concepts in the mind. Because when you think about a letter, if you're a synesthete with this form of synesthesia, you'll see colours and so on. So there you go. The first problem is it's not always sensory. And actually, when you think about the kind of colours you see as a grapheme colour synesthete, that doesn't have to be a sensory experience either, because lots of synesthetes with grapheme colour synesthesia experience those colours not as something they see in the world, but as something they know or as something they can picture extremely clearly in the mind's eye. So although there's a very nice, straightforward example of hearing music and seeing colours projected into space, which does exist, there are also lots of kinds of synesthesia that are not sensory at all. And, you know, don't get me started. That's just the beginning of that problem with that definition. But it is useful as well, because it does capture in a nutshell, in a very easy way, to explain what synesthesia kind of is at its core, which is a kind of merging of the senses.
Fantastic.
Bet you wish you hadn't asked. Now, it's complicated.
It is complicated. Also, the sequence-based synesthesia is a bit of a tricky one. Like, it doesn't really connect senses. So yeah, I'm glad you answered that. It is tricky. Also, to figure out what is a form and what isn't, like someone who imagines a calendar, is that synesthesia? Whereas
the other problem as well is that even scientists can't properly agree on what all the synesthesias are. So a really good example is the calendar synesthesia. So we call it sequence-based synesthesia. It's triggered by any kind of sequence, like letters, they come in a sequence, right, A, B, C, or numbers, they come in a sequence, 1, 2, 3, days of the week, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, months of the year. So it's triggered by these sequences. And what the synesthetic experience is seeing them projected in space, or imagining them somewhere as having specific locations in space. So you might imagine that the months of the year, you might be a synesthete who has the months of the year wrapped around their body in a kind of oval shape. And so you can point, over here is January and over here is December. Now, that has a name that links it to synesthesia, sequence-based synesthesia. But there are some people who have argued that maybe it's not synesthesia at all. It's just really heightened mental imagery. So mental imagery is building a picture in the mind's eye. And it may just be that sequence-based synesthesia is just heightened mental imagery. But then that raises the question of, you know, maybe many kinds of synesthesia are heightened mental imagery, but still synesthesia. I mean, a great example is one of my favourite forms of synesthesia, which is sequence personality synesthesia or sequence personification synesthesia. So I think I named this quite a long time ago as OLP, ordinal linguistic personification. And there are just thousands and thousands of websites about OLP now on the internet. And not everybody agrees that that's a form of synesthesia, because it's particularly not sensory. So it's triggered by thinking about letters and numbers, for example, sequences. And the experience is not a colour, not a taste. It's the very clear sense of a personality. So, for example, A might not be red, but it would be a kind and benevolent mother who takes care of the house. And B might be her toddler son, and C might be the boy next door, and so on. So I'm very much convinced that that's a form of synesthesia for lots of different reasons. But other people might not agree. So, you know, again, this is not an easy definition.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I have no answer to this, but it's the same. I ask the same questions. Yeah. But maybe it gets a bit clearer if we look at what does the brain of a synesthete look like and how is it different to a non-synesthete?
That's a really interesting question, but unfortunately no clearer, because the one thing we can definitively say is that the brains of synesthetes look different. But the nature of that difference is very varied, because there are many, many forms of synesthesia, right? So synesthetes who experience colours, we know that their brains are slightly different in and around visual cortex of the brain. So we do our seeing at the back of the head, strangely. The part of the brain that controls vision is at the back of the head. And in areas around the visual cortex, we can see extra pockets of connectivity in the brains of people who have coloured letters and numbers. And those extra pockets of connectivity are also suspiciously close to the areas of the brain that process graphemes, that process the triggers. So we have this idea, this theory, that synesthesia may be caused or may give rise to a sort of extra connections linking these separate parts of the brain that are very separate from most other people. That's one particular theory. But then again, a different form of synesthesia, like the personification synesthesia, also differences in the brain, but this time differences in the corpus callosum, which is an area of the brain that sort of links the left and right hemispheres. And corpus callosum is involved in lots of social processing. And so it's kind of no surprise to me that personification synesthetes might have differences there. Okay, because for them, the world is a very social place. Even the alphabet is a social place. You know, you have neighbours and friends and men and women and cousins and uncles and neighbours. Very different parts of the brain affected for different forms of synesthesia. And the other difference is that sometimes we see these as extra pockets of connectivity, right? Extra links. But other times we see them as under connectivity. So not quite the strength of connection that you would find in the typical brain. So it's really not a clear picture, but although it is true that synesthetes have special brains.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about ticker tape synesthesia, because right now I'm trying to animate it to give an example of what my ticker tape synesthesia is doing when I'm listening to someone else speaking. It made me think other people who do not have ticker tape, they just get the meaning from what they hear, which is mind-blowing to me. Like, I don't know how to process information if I don't see it written out. So for me, it was more of a thought of maybe it's more of a compensation. Maybe I wasn't very good at auditory processing. So I needed something to compensate that lack.
Sure. First of all, yeah, I also find it equally astonishing that you have ticker tape synesthesia, but because I have nothing like that. And in fact, I'm very much on the opposite end of the spectrum to you. Not only am I not a synesthete, but I also have something called aphantasia, which means I have no visual imagery. I have no pictures in the mind. So, you know, I can't construct a picture of my mother's face. I know exactly what she looks like. I never confuse her for anybody else, but my visual knowledge is not captured by images in my mind. And so for me, I really would be, you know, quite astonished to know that other people have A, pictures, and B, words written out in front of their mental eyes. But, you know, I know of ticker-tape synesthesia, and we actually did a study about 10 years ago with Peter Hancock and one of our fantastic students, Sinead. She was looking at ticker-tape synesthesia, and we were able to show that a group of synesthetes with ticker-tape synesthesia were able to hear words better. So what we did is we took a bunch of single words and we put them in a sentence, like, this is the word house, this is the word car, this is the word caravan, and we recorded them digitally, and then we obscured the words. We put white noise on top so that all you could really hear was and you could not really hear the words very well. And then we played them to a panel of synesthetes and a panel of non-synesthetes, and we found that the synesthetes could detect the word better. They were much able to detect the word when it was hidden in speech. And unfortunately, when you've been an academic for a long time, you have this whole backlog of papers that you need to sort of write up. You know, I've written up quite a lot, but that's one of my papers that I think, oh, I really should write that up, because that's a really interesting piece of literature. But I'm not at all surprised that you have it, but I do find it personally phenomenologically baffling. So that word means I find it hard to know what that must be like.
That's mind-blowing to me. So, I mean, that just goes to show how different our brains work and how our brains really are like reality-producing machines.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's exactly what we are. But people think that the world, the reality, exists out there in the world, and it really doesn't. Mm-hmm. Reality exists in our own brains. It's a construct that we make, you know, from all kinds of information, but reality is certainly an individual construct.
Absolutely. Another thing I'm really interested in is the genetic side. Now, I do know we don't have clear answers, no final answers, but what I find interesting in my family, for example, is that I have synesthesia and my dad has too, but my mum has aphantasia, which is so the opposite.
Yeah, so we have the reverse family. So my mum has synesthesia and I have aphantasia. I mean, I have also thought for a long time that what we're talking about, what may be inherited, is an imbalance in equilibrium. So having a trait at one end of the spectrum, whether that's the upper end or the lower end, you know, I mean, that's on the aside. Obviously, we're talking about case studies and individuals. And so, you know, on a large scale, that may not be true at all. But I have wondered to myself whether my aphantasia is in some way linked to my mother's hyperphantasia and synesthesia. So, yeah. So what are the synesthesias that you guys have going on?
My dad has sequence-based synesthesia. I think there must be a lot more. I'm asking him random questions. But aphantasia is absolutely fascinating. I would love to bring you back to the podcast to talk about that. Also, hyperphantasia, because that's another question, right? Where's the line between synesthesia and hyperphantasia? And is there any? What's the difference?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So imagery and synesthesia are very tightly packed together, although I suspect not in the way that many people think. So science used to tell us, you know, around sort of the beginning of the noughties, there were some really interesting studies that showed that synesthetes have heightened mental imagery. Okay. And that would make sense, right? Because it may be that that was what synesthesia actually was. But I've written a couple of times to say that we have a slight problem with that assumption, because what we do is we self-select. We may be self-selecting synesthetes with higher imagery and not testing the synesthetes who have low imagery. So the reason I think that is that synesthesia is rare, right? I can't open my door at the University of Sussex and look out and hope to see a synesthete. You know, whereas if I were testing any other student population, I could just say, oh, would you like to be in a study? And, you know, lots of hands would go up and I'd have lots of people to test from. But with synesthetes, we really have to rely mostly on synesthetes making an effort to come forward to contact us. They join our testing database and then we test them. But I've been saying for about, I don't know, 2 decades that you know, that's quite a flawed approach, really, because there are lots of things about the kind of person who would come forward for testing completely aside from them having synesthesia. So when you ask yourself what kind of synesthete comes forward, I would suspect synesthetes with high imagery. Why? Because if you have synesthesia and you have high imagery, you're going to really know about your synesthesia. You're going to really have vivid synesthesia that you can see and be aware of. Whereas people without imagery, say someone with very, very low imagery, may well know the colours for the letters of the alphabet, but would not see those as sort of projected in their mind's eye or even projected into space, which sometimes happens. So I think that we have self-selected our population and then we're concluding, oh, look, synesthetes have high imagery, which actually, you know, may not be the case. So a couple of years ago, just in the last couple of years, my PhD student Carla Dance and I set out to test this idea. And so what we did was we went to a population of people with aphantasia, with no mental imagery at all. Now, if synesthesia is imagery, and if high imagery is necessary for synesthesia, we should not have found a single synesthete in our aphantasics because they have no mental imagery. That's not what we found. We found aphantasic synesthetes. And that really shows us very powerfully that synesthesia can exist without imagery and synesthesia is not imagery, but that imagery might make your synesthesia particularly noticeable.
Yeah, I can see that. So what would it look like? Can you give an example for someone who has, for example, auditory visual synesthesia, but aphantasia?
Sure, that would be fine. That would be just simply a case of absolutely knowing what the colours are, but not seeing them in the mind's eye. So, for example, I absolutely know that my big sister has dark hair. I have absolutely no picture of that in my mind's eye, but I absolutely know she has dark hair. I know she has blue eyes. I know exactly what shade of blue eyes she has, but obviously I can't see them because I don't have mental pictures. And it would be like that. So knowing that A is red, B is, you know, turquoise, C is, I don't know, chartreuse, but not actually seeing those.
So would that also describe the difference of a verbal thinker and a visual thinker?
It's a very, very good question. It's exactly the question that we asked ourselves. So when we first started to study aphantasia, we wondered whether what we were looking at was the kind of age-old distinction between verbal and visual thinkers. Someone with high imagery would be a visual thinker. Someone with aphantasia would be a verbal thinker. And that's actually not what we found. So what we found were that people with aphantasia were particularly low verbal thinkers. They did not think to themselves in sentences. They did not hear sounds in their mind's ear. They did not even speak to themselves out loud very much. Okay, so we have plenty of evidence to show that being aphantasic was not the same as being a verbal thinker. And actually, you might then think that someone with aphantasia is, you know, horribly kind of impaired, but having no visual imagery, not being a verbal thinker. But actually, that's not true either. You know, some incredibly creative people are aphantasic. You can be a professor and be aphantasic. It's this, you know, these things are not necessarily deficits. But yeah, it was a good question. And we were surprised by the answer.
That's so fascinating. Okay, I have so many questions. But what I want to go back to the genetics for a second. So we stick to our reintroduction of the basics. What do we know today about the genetics of synesthesia? Do we know anything? I heard you say in a documentary that we know in which street the genetics or the genetic disposition for synesthesia lives, but we don't know in which house.
Yeah, the genetic studies have not been an easy path. They've definitely been, the question's definitely been addressed. Some of my colleagues have looked into this in the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen, over at Baylor College of Medicine, and the early study led by Julian Asher and his colleagues. So there have been studies looking at synesthesia. Some of the early genetic studies suffered really from small numbers. That's understandable. But some of the later studies really have very, you know, we're collaborating in a study that has relatively large numbers of synesthetes. There's not a clear picture because there's not one single gene for synesthesia. And even if there were, there are many types of synesthesia. So we've really not been able to have much of an aha moment. Here it is. There are a few studies that have made pointers. You referred to a street. So what we're talking about here is that So genes are made up of DNA, and sort of the genes themselves are strung together in chromosomes. And we all have 23 pairs of chromosomes. And we can think of DNA as being like concrete, if you like, and genes as being like houses, and chromosomes as being like streets. Okay? And so we have not found the house, the gene for synesthesia, but we do now have a rough idea on some of the, we've found chromosome hotspots. That means we roughly think we know which street they might lie on. But again, the problem is it's so heterogeneous. You know, if you study different families, you're finding different hotspots. So one study found chromosome 16 and another, you know, found something different. So yeah, I think we're at a stage where we know that it's an inherited trait. Okay, not just from gene studies, not just from wet lab studies, but also because we can trace synesthesia through family trees. And it transmits through family trees, but not in the way you would expect if it were learning. So if I have synesthesia and I had a child, you would expect that child to have my synesthesia if I were just teaching them it. But that's not what we see. Mostly it's like you've described with your dad, where your dad has different forms of synesthesia to you. And so you could have someone with tasty words whose sister has coloured letters and whose mother has, I don't know, personification synesthesia. So we know that synesthesia is transmitted through families. We know it's not learning. So we rather suspect that it's genetics, and that the few genetic studies there have been are really homing in on the rough area. But there's so much heterogeneity. There's so much difference. It's a complicated picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Good summary, though. Thank you so much. Another question I would have for you, which is very interesting to me personally as a psychologist, and I'm working as a psychological coach with synesthetes, is even though synesthesia is not a pathology, and rightfully so, we can see that having synesthesia can cause other like well-being differences, mental health struggles. Now, you met synesthetes for the last couple decades. What's your observation of when does synesthesia, maybe you have a couple of examples for when does synesthesia makes us struggle?
So my first answer about what synesthetes are like over the last 20 years, they're all a beautiful kaleidoscope, incredibly different, all different kinds of synesthetes, all kinds of people. But there are certain traits that when we look scientifically are heightened, higher than the general population. One of those is anxiety disorder. So we had a large grant to study synesthesia in children over 5 years. And we found that the rates of anxiety in child synesthetes that we could find objectively, we were not relying on children describing their synesthesia to us. We were doing very careful objective tests so that we knew who the synesthetes were. And what we found was that their rates of anxiety disorder were around 30% when they should have been half that. Now, you don't always see this in adults. We have also seen it in adults, by the way. So in the study with colleague Duncan Carmichael and our lab, we were able to show that there were higher rates of anxiety disorder in adult synesthetes. But you have to be careful how you test for it. In the same way that I was talking about self-selection earlier, if you have a body of synesthetes that you've asked to come forward and to be tested at the lab, so my colleague Jamie Ward has not found anxiety in that kind of population of synesthete. One assumes because a synesthete who's willing to reach out to a professor, make their way to a university, find a room they've never found before, and go and take a study, those are not the synesthetes with anxiety. But when we do random screening, so when we screen populations where we've ruled out self-referral biases, we have found these anxiety disorders. And a number of other things as well. Yeah, higher rates of higher autistic traits does not mean that people with synesthesia have autism, does not mean that everyone with autism has synesthesia, but they're just slightly higher rates than we would expect by chance. There's a particular profile that I've met a surprising number of times, which is that I'm contacted by parents of a child with synesthesia, and this has happened on multiple occasions. It's always been a child around 8 years of age, so usually at a point where a parent's like, things are happening here and it's not just childlike fantasy. And quite often it's been a case of where autism or Asperger's syndrome has co-occurred with synesthesia, and sometimes that can give additional problems. So sometimes in heightened sensory sensitivities. So sometimes lights are too bright, sounds are too loud, and so on. And once or twice there have been specific cases where the synesthesia itself is causing problems, really unpleasant colours, unpleasant tastes in the mouth. One child who was struggling with numbers at school because one of the numbers was a bully. But there's also a very large profile of synesthetes, most synesthetes who are just not affected in negative ways, often highly creative, and yeah, living their best lives as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. What was my question? No, I forgot it. Oh, I wanted to ask you about the term neurodiversity. Is it correct that this is more of a people-made term? Is it more of a pop culture term, or is it used in science? And do you see an overlap of other neurodiversities such as ADHD with synesthesia? Or because I couldn't find any findings on that when I did an ADHD and synesthesia episode.
Yeah. So first of all, do we use the term neurodiversity in synesthesia science? Yeah, we absolutely do. It's very useful. It's a great term. It just basically means that, in a nutshell, undeniably, we are all different to each other. Some people are very much of one trait. Some people are not at all of one trait. And it's just a very nice, useful way to say that there aren't compartments of people, that actually we're on a scale, we're on a spectrum. And there's a nice continuum from, you know, low to high on all kinds of traits. And your second question was?
If you observed any other overlap of neurodiversity, like ADHD and synesthesia, because autism, we do know that there is an overlap.
Sure, yeah, the overlap we've seen has been in autistic traits and anxiety disorder. We did look for ADHD. From memory, we had a quite interesting picture where we looked for ADHD and it seemed to pop up. And then we did what we would always want to do, which is try to replicate, and it disappeared. So I would say the evidence at the moment says no link between ADHD and synesthesia, although we do need to consider that ADHD clusters with autistic traits and autistic traits cluster with synesthesia. So it wouldn't be a huge surprise to me if to find a paper showing that ADHD linked in some way to synesthesia, but it's definitely not been at the tip of the iceberg popping out of the water, obvious for everybody to see. Thus far.
And how about dyslexia and other?
Again, no definitive evidence.
Yeah.
No definitive evidence. And in some ways, one would expect synesthetes to be slightly better spellers if we, okay, I'm condensing dyslexia down to a very fundamental, I'm over reducing dyslexia at the moment when I talk about spelling, because obviously dyslexia has a lot more to do with language processing overall. But if we consider spelling, anecdotal reports are often that synesthetes find spelling a little easier because they can use the colours as a crutch. So, you know, is it dependent or is it dependant? Well, it's a yellow colour at the end, so it must be A-N-T.
Yeah.
I hope. I'm saying that right.
Well, it's blue, but I can relate to that. That's a good example.
I got the wrong example for a second. So you got the wrong spelling because I was thinking about... So this is very interesting. So I got the wrong spelling of dependent because I don't have synesthesia. But over the last 20 years, my letters have taken on colours. Mm. And the interesting thing is, not very much. I doubt I would pass as a synesthete. But one of my letters that's taken on a colour is the letter A, and it's taken on the colour yellow. So when I said dependent, it's yellow at the end. My brain made that an A, whereas, of course, dependent is actually spelt with an E. So, yeah, that's really fun. That's really fun. And it's quite interesting to me, though, because the colours that my letters have taken on are not the colours they should have taken on. So I did some of the seminal work showing what colours letters tend to be for synesthetes. And more than anybody in the world, I know that an A should be red. Scientifically, it should be red. But my A has developed the colour yellow. Why is that? I mean, it may be interesting that my mother is a synesthete. It may be that having a very, very low level disposition for synesthesia that was not expressed, if you bombard that brain with 20 years of synesthesia research and 20 years of the idea of colours, that some of that disposition may rise to the surface. So I do wonder sometimes whether that happened.
Interesting. Yeah. No, yellow A makes me feel uncomfortable.
I can imagine. I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that. I've seen a really beautiful illustration, and I'm unfortunately blocking on the amazing artist who did this, which is it will come back to me. But a representation I saw at a conference of how synesthetes can feel uncomfortable when they're confronted with the wrong colors according to the synesthesia. So the depiction she produced was a banana, which was a pickle in the middle. So it was kind of green undulating pickle in the middle, but obviously it should have been a banana. And that kind of discomfort was her best analogy to explain to a non-synesthete what it was like to hear somebody say that A is yellow when I guess for you it is
red.
Red, right.
That's very interesting. That would also be a really nice portrait series of taking photos of people when they're exposed to the wrong color.
Yeah, or having them, you know, put it into an analogy. I would like to see that.
So before we wrap it up, I have one more question, and that is, what do you want people to know about synesthesia?
Gosh, okay, I would like people to know that synesthesia exists, that synesthesia is a genuine phenomenon, that it is not a flight of fancy, that it is brain-based, that children with synesthesia should be believed, that there are many wonderful positive traits associated with synesthesia. There are some less favourable traits, but overall a synesthete is a tapestry of, you know, mixed traits, of which synesthesia can just be one of them.
Wonderful. Thank you so, so much. This was amazing, so, so helpful. I'm sure it was helpful to many, many people. And plan, as for now, is to translate this interview in a couple languages that my friends speak, to make it more accessible for people around the world to get these big information in an auditory format. Because reading papers is not that easy for everybody. Listening to an interview is much easier. So I want to provide that kind of resource.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you so, so much. And I would love to bring you back for another topic if we ever find the time to do so.
Yep. Very, 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 very much my pleasure. You have my permissions to do whatever you do with your cast. And yeah, good luck with it.
Thank you so, so much.
Take care. And well, see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk Synesthesia. There'll be a new episode of Series 1 every Tuesday. If you enjoyed listening, you can like, follow, and share. Details about the podcast and how to connect with today's speakers can be found in the show notes. The executive producer was Micah Pricing, with music by Karen Anderson, and the podcast was supported by a couple more neurodivergent people in the background. See you next week.